Right, so without further ado, pleased to introduce Colin Skelly and giving the talk From Necessity to Freedom, Why Labour Vouchers Aren't Money but Won't Be Needed in a Socialist Society. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So Karl Marx obtained his PhD in philosophy, but through his vast reading and criticism of past and contemporary political economists, he became a crack monetary theorist. So I thought it was a good place to start was to look at what Marx thought money was, and then what he thought about labour money, about proposals about labour money, and then to look at what Marx thought about labour vouchers and why he thought they weren't money. And then after that, I'll look at what the SPGB have thought about labour vouchers and offer a few thoughts of my own on the subject as well. So in the opening chapters of Capital, Marx sets out to determine why different commodities exchange in certain ratios. So he came up with his famous dictum that because a commodity in exchange is equated to a certain quantity of another commodity, and because this ratio can't be put down to anything within the article itself, within the two articles themselves, they must therefore be reducible to a third thing, a common property that is present in equal amounts in both things. What he said was, congeal quantities of homogeneous human labour, and as crystals of this social substance, which is common to them all, they are values, commodity values. So these are the opening pages of Capital. But a given commodity is not worth the actual total hours of labour embodied in it, only the amount of labour that is necessary on average to make it in a given society. So Marx says, what exclusively determines the magnitude of the value of any article is therefore the amount of labour socially necessary for its production. The individual commodity counts here only as an average sample of its kind. Commodities which contain equal quantities of labour or which can be produced in the same time have therefore the same value. So after establishing this point, Marx moves on to the nature of money, which he argues arises from the exchange of commodities. So whilst a barter economy can exist with the actual exchange of goods, for example, a string of beads for a cow or a goat for 10 bags of barley, say, this method quickly became impractical as exchange ceased to become a fringe economic activity and became an increasingly prevalent and important feature of social production. So another means of exchange was required, a universal equivalent that allowed multiple exchanges of many different types of commodities, i.e. money. He has this to say, which is, because all commodities as values are objectified human labour and therefore in themselves commensurable, their values can be communally measured in one and the same specific commodity. And this commodity can be converted into the common measure of their values, that is, into money. Money as a measure of value is a necessary form of appearance of the measure of value which is imminent in commodities, namely labour time. So over time, Marx says gold comes to fulfil this function, largely because the amount of labour required to mine it remains relatively stable across time, and because it can be conveniently melted down and shaped into convenient shapes and sizes. Now, it functioned effectively as a universal equivalent for exchange of commodities across different activities and between different regions and countries in a way that, say, exchanging cattle or any other universal commodity, you know, just wasn't as effective. Money was the most effective. Gold was the most effective thing that could be found, and later, a little bit later, silver as well. So money, then, is just another commodity, initially gold, that serves a function as a convenient means of exchange for other commodities. In the section in Capital on the fetishism of commodities, Marx discusses the way in which money helps commodities appear to have a life that exists independently of human productive activity, an indirect relation between humans, obscuring the social relations of production. And there's a little quote from Marx I quite like. It says, a particular social relation between men themselves, which in their eyes assumes a phantasmagorical form of a relation between things. Now, I don't know if the translation in all editions is phantasmagorical, but it basically, things appear like this cup would be worth £1. It appears to have a value or life of its own that gives it that value. And I'm not going to talk about that today, but that's just an interesting aside. Now, over the passage of time and the extension of commodity production, until it became a predominant economic activity, exchange was facilitated through coins and then through paper notes. So gold coins and then to notes transferable into gold. That one's the reign of George V, so it's interwar, so 1920s. And then changes into paper money that's not transferable into gold, what's called fiat money, which is just a representation of money, which is what we have today. So that £10 note in the end is fiat money, not transferable into gold. Or it has no physical representation at all. It's either scribbles on a ledger, or today, numbers on a screen. And today, around 97% of money is held purely as numbers on a screen. But the same principle holds. Paper money or digital money still expresses the value of a commodity. How much of the third thing, congealed, abstract, socially average human labour that is embodied in it? So that's what Marx thought about money, where it came from, how it evolved. And what did he have to say about labour money? Was his writings generally took the form of critiques of others. So Capital is subtitled A Critique of Political Economy. And among those critiqued in Capital was Pierre-Joseph Proudhon.
There he is.
He put forward some ideas about money with which Marx disagreed. And in short, Proudhon argued that money, as it existed, was the root of social problems. But independent producers just could not get hold of enough of it because it was stolen through unequal exchange, interest and rent. Money should, he argued, exist only as labour money, a means of equal exchange for labourers organised on mutual cooperative lines. So Proudhon therefore advocated commodity exchange, but without money as it had evolved to facilitate that exchange. Now for Proudhon, commodities should exchange equally according to the number of hours embodied in them. Unequal exchange he regarded as theft of property, hence his famous assertion that property other than labour is theft. The problem with this is, of course, a chair, for example, that a slow worker or one with rubbish tools took 10 hours to produce will be worth twice as much as a more enthusiastic worker or a worker with better tools took to make with five, which is an unworkable proposition in an economy of commodity exchange. And commodities produced for exchange rapidly arrived back at a value that was determined by the socially average amount of labour that was in it. The socially average amount of labour embodied in them. So if one chair took 5 hours to make and another 10, then the value of a chair would be 7.5 hours. So in response to this, Marx said that money already was, in many senses, labour money, allowing the determination of exchange value of commodities by reflecting the amount of socially necessary labour embodied in them. Marx argues that workers do receive an equivalent, a price based on the value of a worker's labour power, not their labour itself. The product of labour is alienated from workers at the point of production. The difference between the value exchanged for labour power and that embodied in the commodities produced is surplus value or profit. Marx referred to this also as paid and unpaid labour. And to refer then, as Proudhon did, to workers receiving the full value of their labour is to conceive of the continuance of capital-labour relations but without surplus value, which is clearly a nonsense. And the problems faced by those trying to organise production on cooperative lines was not located in the nature of money or of the means of exchange, but in the relations of production themselves. And with the continued existence of commodity production, cooperative firms would exist in competition with private firms, forcing both types of enterprise to maximise the appropriation of surplus value. In the end, the desire to facilitate equal exchange would give way to the need for capital to expand. Wouldn't work. Another quote from Marx, which says, labour money, so Proudhon's idea of labour money, of equal exchange, in a society founded on the production of commodities makes a mistake of presupposing the production of commodities while at the same time, by juggling with money, trying to circumvent the necessary conditions of that form of production. So money is the result of commodity exchange itself. So Marx was arguing, if commodity production continued, so the nature of money must develop the forms which facilitate it. It was the nature of production that determined the existence of money and financial forms, not the other way round. And Marx likened Proudhon's ideas on labour money to trying to abolish a king in a monarchy or the Pope in Catholicism. If you removed it, a new one would just arise up to fulfil its place. So if you had commodity exchange, money would just arise. It's a function of commodity exchange itself. So the ideas put forward by Proudhon that Marx was attempting to overcome have proved to have longevity. Perhaps understandably to some extent, as workers struggle to make ends meet, and service debt, Proudhon's notion of equal exchange, worker to worker, without debt and profit, retain a resonance. Today, ideas of reforming money to some sort of posited original form as mere means of equal exchange, as if it isn't already, remain as pervasive and seemingly impervious to Marx's criticism as ever, taking on new and technocratic forms all the time. So that's Proudhon and labour money. But what did Marx have to actually say about labour vouchers themselves? In short, labour vouchers don't presuppose, as Proudhon did, the continued existence of an economy based on exchange of commodities, but on a rationalised plan of production. So goods aren't produced for exchange with other goods. Labour vouchers were not a means of exchanging goods, but for allocating resources designated for immediate consumption. So Marx's comments on the labour vouchers put forward by Robert Owen in his Model Communities. And he says this: Owen's labour money is no more money than a theatre ticket is. Owen presupposes directly socialised labour, a form of production diametrically opposed to the production of commodities. The certificate is labour is merely evidence of the part taken by the individual in the common labour, of his claim to a certain portion of the common product which has been set aside for consumption. But that only applies to Owen's model communities, they're set up as isolated communities outside of the general economy. Owen had also been involved in the establishment of a national equitable labour exchange in London in 1832. Through which labour vouchers were issued for goods embodying a given amount of hours, exchangeable for vouchers and goods for the same amount of hours. So there we have a tone, it's not that clear actually, but it's National Equitable Labour Exchange, Birmingham branch, labour voucher for 40 hours. And the scheme was established in 1832, and briefly, it captured the imagination of artisans and independent small producers, but rapidly dwindled and closed in 1834, and the Birmingham branch only lasted less than a year, 1833. There we are. And money, notes and coin, exchangeable for gold, proved to be a far more effective means for determining socially necessary labour time embodied in goods produced for exchange. And it's difficult not to see modern movements ultimately aim for an economy of free exchange, such as Paracon and Zeitgeist, as similar in many respects to the ideas of Proudhon and Owen, warmed up for the 21st century, and advocating as they do continuance of commodity production whilst trying to shape its evolution into something else, through operating parallel systems of exchange. Whilst commodity production exists, it is difficult to see why money as it exists will not prevail as a superior means of facilitating the exchange of multifarious goods across the globe, which would squeeze out any attempts at parallel systems of exchange rather than giving way to them. Marx went into more detail about his views on labour vouchers in another critique, this time of the Goethe programme, produced when the German Social Democratic Party unified in 1875. Now, in this critique, Marx takes to task the phraseology of Ferdinand Saul, gentleman there, whose followers made up part of the new unified party, particularly phrases such as fair distribution of the proceeds of labour, which he sort of snuck into the programme of the new party. Marx says that the idea of an exchange of equivalents, of receiving back what you have put in, is a mindset carried over from capitalism, giving rise to another famous comment that what we have to deal with here is a communist society, not as it has developed on its own foundations, but on the contrary, just as it emerges from capitalist society, which is thus, in every respect, economically, morally, and intellectually still stamped with the birthmarks of the old society from whose womb it emerges. Now, in such circumstances, Marx states an alternative to money might be labour vouchers, which would allow that the same amount of labour which the worker has given to society in one form, he receives back in another. Now, he acknowledges that with labour vouchers, obviously the same principle prevails as that which regulates the exchange of commodities, as far as it's the exchange of equal values, and that is still burdened by, you know, as being sort of a bourgeois limitation. He says it is still perpetually burdened with a bourgeois limitation. Furthermore, because labour vouchers take into account only direct labour undertaken, it takes no account of physical or mental differences between workers. So one worker works faster than another, you don't get rewarded anymore. Nor does it distinguish between those who are married, or with children, or any sort of physical disabilities. Marx therefore calls this right of exchange a right of inequality. It recognises, and this is another quote from Marx, it recognises no class differences because everyone is only a worker like everyone else, but it tacitly recognises unequal individual endowment and thus productive capacity of the worker as natural privileges. So the equal exchange represented by labour vouchers was actually therefore a right to be unequal rather than equal. So why then does he think that labour vouchers might be necessary if he throws all those criticisms at it? Because he explains in another famous passage that socialist society would at first be subject to the defects which are inevitable in the first phase of communist society, as it is when it's just emerged after prolonged birth pangs from capitalist society. Right can never be higher than the economic structure of society and its cultural development conditioned thereby. And he continues. He says, in a higher phase of communist society, after the enslaving subordination of the individual to the division of labour, and with it also the antithesis between mental and physical labour, has vanished, after labour has become not only a means of life, but life's prime want, after the productive forces have also increased with the all-round development of the individual, and the springs of cooperative wealth flow more abundantly, only then can the narrow horizon of bourgeois right be crossed in its entirety, and society inscribe on its banners that famous phrase, from each according to his ability to each according to his needs. Now Marx is making clear, to me at least, that the achievement of socialism will not be a millennial event, ushering in new socialist men and women, but will be built from where capitalism left off, by people who have lived within capitalist productive relations. He's not saying that there needs to be a period of interim development before communism is possible, but that following a revolution in which the means of production become the property of all, freedom from necessity at last becomes a real possibility. Development of technology will continue, not to grow capital, but to grow ourselves. To put the means of production at our service and not us at the service of the means of production. Or as Marx put it, the beginnings of production of wealth as an end in itself. But the passages of Marx that we just read on labour vouchers in the critique of the Goethe programme have been used to justify the existence of money and wages in state capitalist countries, and by extension, the necessity for a transitional society between capitalism and communism. Now, this notion was exacerbated by the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917 in Russia, but it existed well before that date. The idea of a transition period from capitalism to communism has existed as long as the words socialism and communism have been in use. Now, even a socialist revolution such as William Morris talked of the probability of a lengthy period of state socialism before workers finally put an end to capitalism. And with Belfort Bax in Socialism from the Root Up, talks of a lengthy transition in which money will still exist. Now, a political party as close to the SPGB at its formation as the Socialist Labour Party advocated labour vouchers not as a temporary feature of a transition, but as a permanent feature of socialist society. So Marx argued that in socialism, direct social labour is established, the production of a common store of goods for use, not exchange, where all labour counts, not just that which can be sold or is socially average or above. Now this could take the immediate form of an exchange of equivalents of labour as labour vouchers for access to goods for immediate consumption. But Marx makes it clear this is not the goal of socialism, communism, which is to transcend the need for exchange and calculations based on common measures, such as labour, altogether. The critique of the Goethe programme is not a case for labour vouchers, but a negative critique of its limitations. And the whole question of labour vouchers and their necessity or desirability is intimately related to contending political views as to the necessity of a lengthy transition period, what's commonly called socialism, between capitalism and communism, or whether socialism and communism, as the SPGB suggests, are more or less synonymous. Although, as I've already said, the concept of a transition period has always existed amongst those calling themselves socialist and communist, it became received wisdom in the 20th century, to anyone sort of outside of the SPGB it became received wisdom that socialism was an interim stage of development distinct from communism. In large part, this is due to the influence of Lenin, whose views can be distinguished from those of Marx. So Marx, in the critique of the Goethe program, says that between capitalist and communist society lies a period of revolutionary transformation of the one into the other. There corresponds to this also a political transition period in which the state can be nothing but a revolutionary dictatorship of the proletariat. Well, Lenin, in State and Revolution in 1917, Adam, what date was State and Revolution? 1917, thank you. Shifted the emphasis. The transition from capitalist society to communist society is impossible without a political transition period. So for Lenin, socialist revolution would bring in a society that both wasn't capitalism, from which communism would slowly emerge. Political power is seized, followed by a prolonged period of social transmutation in which the state, money and wages would continue. Now for Marx, and the two passages make this clear, a socialist revolution would involve the overcoming of the capital-labour relation once and for all, and the establishment of a new form of productive relations transcending the need for the state, money and wages, but that, as he said in the Goethe program, would not emerge fully formed, but would develop over time. But it in no way sort of suggests this period of stages that sort of Leninists that we've all heard many, many times. So that's what Marx thought about money, labour vouchers. Why did the SBGB reject labour vouchers? This is largely because it's always rejected the attempt, the concept of an extended period of transition between capitalism and communism. It's always resisted the separation of socialism and communism as having different meanings. The political transition period for the SBGB has always meant what it did for Marx. The revolutionary shift from minority ownership of the means of production to common ownership of the means of production. The SBGB have also been a minority current in Marx's political thought for rejecting the idea that capitalism could be overcome without an overt political act of overcoming it, an act that must be wrought by workers themselves and not on their behalf. Now, if such a revolution were to be achieved in an advanced capitalist economy, as Britain was in 1904, but which Germany was only beginning to become in 1875, if the working class was to free itself to grab hold of the means of living, with all of its vast potential, currently shackled to expanding value, and use it for the first time for conscious human ends, why would labour vouchers be necessary? Where Marx was equivocal about the possibility of labour vouchers in the context of Germany in 1875, the SBGB from the first rejected their necessity. In 1920, in the Socialist Standard, Jack Fitzgerald replied to a correspondent asking as to whether the remuneration of workers in socialism should be determined by the social labour time provided, labour vouchers, or whether the total social product would be divided up equally. And Fitzgerald's reply was short and sweet. He said neither method would prevail. The best method of distribution will be to allow each as much as he or she desires of the social products. Each would contribute to the social production according to his capacity, and it would be a waste of time and energy to measure out what each should have. Now, this early rejection of labour vouchers has carried on until the present day and includes criticism of let schemes and the like. In short, the SBGB agrees with Marx that labour vouchers aren't money, but, you know, if operated for any length of time, as anything other than a temporary measure in time of shortage, would probably circulate and de facto become money. And the SBGB has asserted that a situation of shortage would in any case be unlikely, given that socialism was about accessing the potential abundance held out by advanced capitalist economies. Now, importantly, the SBGB has also held out that labour vouchers would just not be needed, that the pressing concern post-capitalism would be the planning of production and distribution of use values, not working out a new means of calculating exchange. But the rejection, I think, runs deeper than these quite practical objections. It strikes at the heart of the problem for socialists, the need for socialist consciousness prior to a socialist revolution. Now, other Marxist parties have held that the new socialist man emerges from change mode of production, that change must therefore be either evolutionary or incremental by stages, and hence the popular conception of a higher and lower stage of socialism and communism. But I don't think this is an accurate interpretation of Marx's conception of revolution. I mean, change involves consciousness of ideas emerging from material conditions, but they thereby change them. Capitalism did not emerge from feudalism automatically. It was made, read in tooth and claw, as Marx put it. Likewise, socialism requires a working class consciousness of what it wants to achieve, an idea of an alternative to capitalist production and the will to achieve it. Ideas really are important. As Morris put it, socialism required intelligence enough to conceive, courage enough to will, power enough to compel. Or as Marx put it in a letter, the world has long had the dream of something. I must only possess the consciousness of it in order to possess it actually. Now, although much scorn was poured by Marx on the work of idealists, he did not think of himself as advancing purely materialism, but as of humanism. This is a quote from Marx, a humanism which distinguishes itself from idealism and from materialism, and is at the same time the truth uniting both. So socialism is not at its core mere ownership of the means of production or equality for its own ends, but as a means to a fuller, freer life, an end to human slavery, to the internal logic of capitalist production. And Marx himself wrote that communism is not as such the goal of human development, the form of society aimed at. And the Marxist, humanist and economist Andrew Kleinman, who this time last year was at head office at Clapham giving a talk, he has written recently, before any definite socialist action can be attempted, it must be backed up by a great body of intelligent opinion, the opinion of a great mass of people who are already socialists, people who know what they want and are prepared to accept the responsibilities of self-government, which must form part of their claims. And he has framed the issue for the 21st century, for 21st century socialism, as one of not taking power, but of what happens after. Regular people are not just a muscle that brings down the old power, but need to become fully equipped, theoretically and intellectually, to govern society themselves. It seems utopian, but there really is no alternative. And this sounded so much like the SPGB, but the other socialist party commented on it. That Kleinman was really a utopian, just like us. So Kleinman is therefore very close in his political outlook to the SPGB. He's also interested in the role of labour vouchers as a post-revolutionary step. Well, I find that quite difficult to accept. And do we return, after the great struggles that must be part of a socialist revolution, to an exchange of equivalents for our labour power? Or do we rather immediately embrace the critical distinction between capitalist society and the idea of a socialist society? For there will be no need of exchange of equivalents at all. Well, I think it must be the latter. Marx was writing about debates within a political party in Germany in the context of an economy not yet fully industrialised. Labour vouchers are not only not necessary, but continued assertions of their necessity obscure the abundance that actually already exists, albeit distributed unevenly. Socialists in the 19th century emphasised the need to rationalise production in order to ensure abundance, so that we all have enough to live comfortably, to move, as Marx put it, from the realm of necessity to the realm of freedom. Well, today, socialists are concerned as much with rational consumption as rational production in the face of ecological crisis. So when production becomes an end in itself, if socialism becomes an actuality, the immediate global challenge may not be, as with labour vouchers, to allocate scarce resources, but actually to produce less, not more.